Chapter 8, Principle 3. Fight pain until you win.
Try a blend of mental and physical therapies until you can live with the pain. Don't give up until you find the formula that works for you.
I have a confession to make. In my first version of this book, I left out the subject of pain. I didn't mention it once, as if pain weren't an issue for people with chronic illness. When the publisher read the draft, he said, "Lori, I really like your book, but I have one question. Why didn't you include anything on pain?" The question threw me for a loop. How could I have sidestepped such an important subject? That's the equivalent of leaving flour out of a cake. So I sat down at the computer and asked myself, what happened? After a bit of soul-searching, I came to a realization. I was afraid. Somewhere inside, I felt that if I acknowledged the pain, I would make it real, and I would begin to feel what I've pushed to the back of my mind for so long. If you live with chronic pain, you can probably relate. We pretend it isn't there so we can go on, keep moving, keep living. It's a strategy that works, so I'm not going to be a hypocrite and tell you, face your pain head on, you'll be a stronger person for it. No. When it comes to pain, I'm all for denial. When that denial is mixed with a strong mental attitude and, for many of you, the right medication, you will be able to manage your pain. I've lived with discomfort for so long, I have stories about it that stretch deep into my childhood. My coping strategies were born in my youngest years, so that is where I'll begin.
We could never learn to be brave and patient if there were only joy in the world. Helen Keller.
My journey with pain. Not without my favorite blue dress. I was 12, and it was a hot August day. My mom and I were in a doctor's office in Pasadena. All of a sudden, I felt very heavy. I wanted to lay flat on the floor. The doctor called my nephrologist at Children's Hospital, and he instructed my mom to get me to the hospital immediately. I dropped in and out of consciousness the entire ride, and as my mom pulled into the driveway, I opened the door of the moving car and fell onto the hot pavement. I had on my favorite outfit, a blue sundress covered in big red flowers. As I fell, it protected most of me, but not my legs. They burned on the asphalt. I was aware of the stinging sensation, but I couldn't move my body. I lay still as a rag doll on the fiery ground. The security guard rolled out a wheelchair, scooped me into it, and my mom frantically rushed me to the dialysis unit. She fought to keep me propped up as I repeatedly slipped down the chair, like Heinz ketchup slowly dripping out of its bottle. At the dialysis unit, someone put me on the treatment table. I didn't feel any pain, but something must have registered because a few moments later, I looked at one of my nephrologists at the time, Dr. Crystal, and said, "I don't feel right." That's when my heart stopped, and Dr. Crystal performed the CPR that would save my life. As she worked on me, I saw the treatment room from above. Many healthcare professionals were feverishly pounding at my chest. I felt calm and relaxed, and I was not afraid. It was as if I were watching the television program Emergency from afar. Then I noticed my blue dress all cut up at the end of the table. I became very angry. "Why did they have to ruin my favorite dress?" I remember thinking. And that's it. The end of my so-called out-of-body experience. Maybe I decided to come back to mend my dress. Who knows? The next thing I remember is waking up in intensive care. I had tubes in every orifice of my body. My chest was aching, and the doctors were still at it, trying desperately to lower my potassium level, the lethal mineral that almost killed me. When I awoke in intensive care, I felt strangely euphoric, despite the bruises on my chest and the overall pain. When I breathed, it felt as though fresh air reached the tip of my toes. In fact, I felt so good, I kept trying to get up and leave. The last thing I heard was, "Give her a sedative so we can stabilize her." I was able to shut out the pain. I, or the mental part of me, went away as my body experienced the discomfort. Where I went, I'm not sure. But I visited this place again later in life, after I received my third kidney transplant. A plea for help. I was driving to my singing class. What a dreadful day it had been. I started the morning at 4:30 with 4 hours of dialysis. I had worked all day, and now I was on the freeway not going more than 10 miles an hour. Dialysis was a regular part of my life now. It had been for 12 years and probably was going to be for the rest of my days. A hard fact to accept at 23 years old. The doctors had told me my chances of undergoing a successful kidney transplant were slim to none, and it had been 7 years since the organ procurement agency had called me. My life was riddled with needle sticks, infections, and an endless stream of uncertainties about my health. And on this night, I just couldn't shake the sadness. I knew I needed a fix, and singing had always been a way for me to release the emotional pain. When I finally reached the school, the teacher called upon me to sing first. I agreed, reluctantly. My voice was not much louder than a whisper, and I was trembling. The teacher said, "Lori, you're not used to being heard, are you?" Her words triggered something in me that I had always felt. My way of coping was to ignore the pain, to hold back the fear and sadness. If I acknowledged these feelings, I feared the dam would burst and I would never stop crying. And that's exactly what happened. I broke down in front of my classmates and cried. The type of cry where I couldn't catch a breath. I never did sing my song. I had to excuse myself and leave. But the crying didn't stop. It happened again the next day, all day. I was in so much physical and emotional pain, I remember praying, "Please, God, help me." Though the plea gave me some comfort, the melancholy continued to gnaw at me. Maybe I need to connect with what is good in my world, I thought, so I turned to my friends. And we packed up and we went on a camping trip. I was on my way out the door when I remembered something. I ran back inside and left a note on the fridge saying where I'd be just in case there was an emergency at home. Arriving at camp on Friday night, my plan was working. I felt a new hope in the beauty of the mountains, and I had a glimmering of that euphoric sensation I first experienced years ago after my near-death experience when my breath seemed to travel to my toes. The next morning, I was tossing around a volleyball with my friends when I heard from a distance, "Has anyone seen Lori?" The woman was yelling quite frantically, and I ran toward her anxiously, sure there had been a tragedy at home. To my surprise, when she handed me the phone, I was speaking to the transplant coordinator. "Lori," she said, "I think we have a kidney for you." I was in surgery that evening. The next thing I remember is waking up in intensive care on a ventilator. They told me I had had 4 respiratory arrests, and it was Tuesday. The next 2 weeks were living hell. I had to return to surgery because my access had clotted, and every day the doctors and nurses prodded at me, trying to get the kidney to start functioning. One evening, the doctors gathered around my bed and told me it was over. There was nothing else they could do. My kidney wasn't responding. In essence, it was sleeping, and the chances of it waking up were very slim. Did I want to see a grief psychiatrist, they wondered, knowing this was probably my last chance at getting a healthy kidney. The match had been perfect. There was just something about my body that refused to accept this transplant. I don't know why you're telling me this, I shot back at all of them. My kidney is going to work, so please leave me alone. Once alone, I rubbed the area over my new organ like I would have pet a beloved dog. God, I said, I know you wouldn't bring me this far just to leave me. Please, let this work. About an hour later, the room was very still, and an eerie feeling came over me. I closed my eyes and started to weep softly. Then I felt a gentle touch on my arm. Lori, are you all right? I looked up and saw my close friend, Bill. When I told him what the doctors said, he replied, Doctors don't always know how things will turn out. This kidney's going to work. You deserve it. It's just going to take some time. He held me in his arms, and I prayed and cried some more. After he left, I nodded off to sleep, only to wake up 2 hours later in disbelief. I had to go to the bathroom. I had to go to the bathroom even though I hadn't gone in 12 years. I rang the nurse, and she humored me by helping me to the toilet. A miracle! To my amazement and hers, my kidney worked.
Real friendship is shown in times of trouble. Prosperity is full of friends. Euripides.
Non-pharmaceutical strategies. Use your mind and your mouth to combat pain. Everyone arrives at their own solution to pain. There is no one formula, and what has worked for me in my life may not work for you. It may help, though, to see the route I've taken, and perhaps you can learn a couple of shortcuts along the way. There are three crucial non-pharmaceutical elements in my battle with pain, as you can see from my stories. First, I allow myself to detach from my physical body. Since I've been fighting pain so long, I think I was almost born with this capability. But for those of you new to pain, such a method can be fostered through techniques like relaxation. Next, I lean on my loved ones. In my darkest moments, I turned to my friends and family and said, I hurt. Even though I know they can't do anything about it, just by giving voice to the pain, I feel better. Lastly, I turn to God. I know there is a power greater than myself, and that being, whoever it is, had a hand in the success of my last kidney transplant. I am not espousing any particular spiritual path here, or even saying you have to believe in God to fight pain. I'm saying that, for me, giving up my physical and emotional hurts to God works. Find spiritual relief. A quick search on the internet will tell you I'm not alone in turning to God during times of suffering. Web rings where members pray for the health of their loved ones and strangers abound. And there are numerous internet sites, Christian, Jewish, New Age, non-denominational, dedicated to the relationship between spirituality and pain. In the real world, Hospitals have on-call spiritual ministers, like priests and rabbis, and lots of clinical studies have been done on the effects of prayer on healing. An article in Paraplegia News noted that prayer is making a medical comeback. Given that 94% of Americans believe in God or some other higher power, it is not surprising that 75% of patients think their physicians should address spiritual issues as part of medical care. Lisa Copen is the founder of Rest Ministries, a nonprofit Christian organization dedicated to helping people with chronic illness. She says she deals with her discomfort from fibromyalgia and rheumatoid arthritis by finding purpose in the pain. When we open ourselves up to God's plan, the pain becomes bearable, she explains on her website. She feels her mission is to share her struggles through the Rest Ministries, which in turn brings comfort to members of her group. I have found a joy beyond description in being able to use my earthly weaknesses toward God's greater good. But you don't have to believe there is a grand design to turn to a higher power to salve the pain. Simply praying to whomever you see fit can bring great relief. A debate raged on the letters page in the June 26, 2000 edition of the Archives of Internal Medicine, a trade journal that publishes research and articles for physicians. The topic was a 1999 study on the effectiveness of remote intercessory prayer on heart patients. The research found that the patients who were prayed for had a markedly lower number of clinical events during their hospital stays. Letter writers ranged from those who took issue with the researchers' methodology to those who lauded the team for tackling a difficult and under-researched topic. Fred Rosner, a doctor in New York, weighed in with his take. But does the efficacy of prayer have to be scientifically proved? Prayer can ameliorate or prevent despair and despondency. Prayer sets a psychological frame of mind to allow the body's psyche to be at rest with itself. Since ancient times, it has been known that the state of mind of a sick person influences the response to treatment. The general use of prayer as a modality of treatment for the sick is not, in itself, a prima facie argument in favor of the efficacy of prayer. The fact remains, however, that the majority of mankind prays for the sick at one time or another. The prayers may differ in content, in the manner in which they are offered, or to whom they are addressed, but both religious and non-religious people alike offer prayers for recovery when they are sick. Prayers have a way of making us feel less alone, of making us feel that someone, somewhere out there, understands and will lend us aid. They let us hand over our struggle. They give us a chance to say, I'm tired. You deal with it. Talk it out. Friends have a remarkable ability to do the same thing. As you fight your pain, remember what I did with my friend Bill as I lay in the dark hospital room silently crying. I shared my burden. In her healing practice using Jewish prayers and traditions, Martha Joy Aft says that most of her clients rely on family and community support to help manage their pain. Connections are critical, Aft says. Occasionally I get an isolated person and they don't seem to do as well. In addition to using meditation and prayer based on Psalms and the Talmud, Aft will sometimes conduct healing circles with the families and friends of her sick clients. Although the patients she works with do not always recover physically, Aft says the work they do with her and with their loved ones helps them to improve in other ways. There's healing in the physical world, but there's also healing in the emotional world, the intellectual world, and the spiritual world. Healing does not mean curing. Some people have been cured of cancers or lived a better lifestyle when they were surviving. Some people have reduced their use of meds or found a sense of meaning. Relaxation techniques. Relaxation is another way to disconnect your mind from the aches that can be a powerful way to gain relief. Leslie Davenport, a holistic health teacher and marriage and family therapist, runs a program at Marin General Hospital where she leads hospital patients through guided imagery sessions to help them prepare or recover from surgery. She also helps her clients alleviate pain. She assists patients in focusing on an imagined safe place where they can direct their minds to escape the discomfort. One patient recovering from cancer came to Davenport's program seeking help from the anxiety and fear that kept her awake at night. The woman was able to visualize her grandmother's farm as her place of peace and relaxation. It became kind of an inner resource where, without me, she could return to, Davenport said. Davenport describes her work with another patient in her 30s who was about to have a hip replacement surgery due to her spina bifida. Her surgeons wanted to wean her off pain medication before surgery so she wouldn't be tolerant to the postoperative analgesics. Davenport used relaxation to aid her. I asked her to bring her focus inside her hip and to let an image form for how she experienced the pain or discomfort. She described in great detail a dagger that went into her hip. I said, "Put your hands there and gently pull it out." As she described a feeling of relief. She also described a boulder resting on her thigh, and she came up with the image of a crane lifting the boulder off and experienced some relief. Her work was to revisit those images as often as she needed. It wasn't unlike taking a pain medication every 4 to 6 hours. Instead of taking a pill every 4 hours, you take a break every 4 to 6 hours. A 1997 study backs up Davenport's anecdotal evidence that relaxation works. The study, conducted by the research arm of Britain's National Health Service, found visualization techniques helped limit pain in patients stricken with several different ailments, including arthritis, joint dysfunction, fibromyalgia, and cancer. 9 studies of 414 patients found that in certain groups, people who used progressive relaxation techniques scored lower on standardized pain scores than those who did not. Evidence like this led the National Institutes of Health to sanction the use of relaxation techniques, including visualization and distraction, where the person focuses on something else to push the pain aside, like music or television. The NIH also deemed other types of non-drug pain relief, such as the mind-body methods of hypnosis and biofeedback, beneficial. Other alternative therapies. In addition to these, there are dozens of other non-pharmaceutical ways chronic pain sufferers can find comfort. Acupuncture and massage, for instance, have both long been lauded for their relieving effects. Many hospitals incorporate them in their treatment programs, and more insurance companies are paying for such services. I, for one, am a big proponent of massage. My monthly massage helps calm my aching joints and helps me disassociate touch with pain, a problem I've dealt with since my youth. Other methods to reduce pain are less widely known, but may carry just as many benefits. Some hospitals are adopting laugh therapy programs based on research that hearty laughter inhibits pain. Paul McGee, author of Health, Healing, and the Amuse System, Humor as Survival Training, explains why. There are about 15 or so studies that show that humor and laughter cause a broad-ranging strengthening of the immune system. Humor and laughter are really good at distracting you from pain. Some doctors believe it triggers the relief of endorphins, but there is no evidence of this at the time. Author and Saturday Review editor Norman Cousins first brought this notion to public attention in his book Anatomy of an Illness, where he describes how he used candid camera clips and Marx Brothers movies to salve the pain of his ankylosing spondylitis, an excruciating disease that causes the connective tissue of the spine to disintegrate.
I made the joyous discovery that 10 minutes of genuine belly laughter had an anesthetic effect and would give me at least 2 hours of pain-free sleep, he writes.
As you can see, you never know where you'll find relief. Choosing the technique that is right for you is very personal and will require a bit of research and experimentation. For that reason, I'm not going to detail all the alternative therapies available to you. I'm just going to list a few of the more well-known so you can get on the internet or go to the library and check them out. Some methods may not work for you, but others have the potential to permanently change your relationship with pain. Acupuncture, acupressure, massage, healing touch, hot or cold compresses, hot showers, hypnosis, magnets, biofeedback, sex, orgasm, chiropractic, yoga.
Seeing much, suffering much, and studying much are the three pillars of learning. Benjamin Disraeli.
Fighting pain with your doctors. Get evaluated, get relief. As I grew into adulthood, I started learning about all the options I had to control pain. Specifically, I spoke with my doctors and I asked other patients what strategies they used. I also learned how to better describe my pain so I could express my needs to my physician and get the proper relief. In the doctor's office setting, with so many things to go over, it can be difficult to talk about your pain in enough detail for the doctor to properly treat it. This is why I suggest you keep a pain diary and bring it with you on your appointments. Doctors often ask you to describe your pain on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being no pain and 10 being the worst pain imaginable. Use this method as you log your discomfort so you and your physician are speaking the same language. Mark down the date, the time, and the source of the pain. If you took medication, stretched, meditated, or tried in any way to get rid of the pain, write that down. Note what works and what doesn't, and whether your score on the scale increased or decreased. You may even want to list the temperature and the humidity factor. I find I have more pain when it's rainy out. Keeping a detailed diary will help you to mark trends in your pain and take proper measures to reduce it before it occurs. For instance, I make sure I wear tights or nylons to keep my legs warm when I know the weather will be wet. Pharmaceutical aid. Once you figure out how to accurately describe the pain, your doctor, if necessary, may prescribe a course of pain medication that will work the best for you. While certain stronger pain medications can mean the difference between a poor quality of life and a good one, they carry their own set of complexities and side effects, making some patients and healthcare providers shy away from them. If you decide to use pharmaceuticals to control your pain, it is critical to speak honestly with your doctor about your medical history, the drugs you are currently taking, side effects, and any concerns you may have. In many cases, people's concerns about pharmaceutical pain management are not well-founded. For example, some patients and physicians avoid certain drugs because they have an unwarranted fear of addiction. As a result, the patient suffers more pain than is necessary. There are so many medications available which can be administered in countless combinations. A solution that will work for you is out there. The key is collaborating with your doctor to develop the proper course. Try, try again. The key to pain management. My history has taught me an important lesson in controlling my pain. Try different solutions until you find the combination that works. This is true of all therapies, pharmaceuticals, alternative practices, and your mental attitude. We have so many options available today, there is no reason you should just put up with unlivable pain. Core to success in this approach is trusting your instincts. You may have to walk away from so-called experts and explore other options, as I did with my arthritis. I began having arthritic problems in my early 20s, an unfortunate result of having an illness so long. After a night of dancing, my knees would be swollen to the size of cantaloupes. I would manage the pain as it flared by seeking injections of corticosteroids. This would leave my knees feeling young and free for a while, but then a few months later, the vicious cycle would continue. Anyone who lives with arthritis knows it enters your life like an unwelcome guest who is determined not to depart. I started avoiding activities that jarred my joints. I'd only dance to my favorite songs when I went out. During long walks, I had to focus on each step. One misstep could leave me laid up for a few days. Eventually, my doctor referred me to an orthopedic surgeon, and it was a disaster. After an abrupt evaluation, he said I needed both my knees replaced. The news came shortly before my Australian honeymoon, where I was to compete in the World Transplant Games. The surgeon must have left his heart at home that day because he sat emotionless, mumbling medical jargon about my x-rays as I cried. "I'm not ready for this type of surgery," I explained.
"Well, then you should be fitted for braces. Until you're ready, there's nothing I can do for you," he replied curtly, stood up, and quickly left.
When I picked up the braces the next week, I was met with a set of neoprene nightmares that I could barely pull over my legs. I could wear only one at a time. Because of my small size, when I wore both, I couldn't stand up straight.
It looked as if I had a corn cob stuck up my... well, you know. I guess this was the surgeon's idea of preventative medicine. If I wore the braces, I certainly wouldn't have knee problems because I'd surely throw out my back. I thought, if this is the expert's solution, I'm in trouble. I decided there was no way he'd ever take a whack at my knees. The next week at my chiropractic appointment, I explained what happened. Dr. Ramsey said, "I have an idea, Lori. Let me see you walk up the hall." I gratefully complied. She asked me if my feet ever hurt. "All the time," I said. "I have a hard time finding shoes that are comfortable." She prescribed orthotics, explaining that my feet were not properly supported, which was having a domino effect on the rest of my body. I cannot tell you how much the orthotics have helped me. The pain improved significantly, and I started to walk with more confidence. And, by the way, I didn't miss a step on my honeymoon. Find comfort in a healthy mind. Once again, try adjusting your focus. So much of this book has been about relying on your psyche to cope with chronic illness. Where our bodies fail us, our minds do not. And so it is with pain. As I've said before, it may help you to accept the pain instead of trying to get back to that place of normal. This is Cynthia Perkins' method. She is a mental health professional who lives with fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome. I believe that we can take a very painful experience and make meaning out of it, she says. In spite of the suffering illness may impose on our lives, it may also help us to change, grow, and learn. My illness has challenged me to redefine my identity, my values, and my priorities, which led me to find deeper meaning in life. Remind yourself of your powerful brain, your renewed trust in relationships, your fresh sense of who you are.
your newfound spirituality. Hone in on the positives your illness has brought, and the pain may be more bearable. Lori's Toolbox 13. Guerrilla Tactics. How to get through the bad days. When you have a chronic illness, sometimes the bad days are predictable, especially if you're on chemo, dialysis, or some other intense type of treatment. Sometimes they're not. When you are met with one, there is often very little you can do to make it any better. You just have to grit your teeth and get through. But there are a few activities that you can pull out of your toolbox during these tough times that may bring some minor relief. Even if they don't, sometimes just taking a proactive step to get rid of the pain can put you in a better frame of mind. Get in water. Taking a bath, jacuzzi, or a swim all have a way of making our problems momentarily float away. Get outside. Even if you're just sitting on your porch or by an open window, the fresh air can do wonders for the soul. Ask a friend to go for a ride. If you aren't struggling with nausea, go for a ride to the mountains, beach, or the woods. The ride will provide a refreshing break, and plugging into nature can help relax your body and spirit. Take a walk. If you're up for it, even a short walk down the street will help. Exercise has long been known to help people maintain their health. Others insist movement can also repair health. In Healing Moves, authors Carol and Mitchell Krukoff pen over 300 pages on how exercise can cure more than 20 disorders. Accept visitors. Accepting visitors when you are really sick may be the last item on your list of things to do, but sometimes a call from a friend can be the greatest boost. Companionship, and a distraction from your own routine, has the potential to be more powerful than any medication. Hang out with animals. Pet therapy offers a known benefit to the sick and people in pain. Hundreds of programs exist across the nation to train dogs and cats for nursing homes and hospital visits, and lots of research has been done on the human companion bond and animal-assisted therapy. According to groups like Therapy Dogs International and the Latham Foundation, animals not only offer entertainment, but they give patients a distraction from the pain, they promote social interaction, they relieve stress, and they motivate physical exercise. See a funny movie. As we've discussed, laughter is a proven pain-reducing agent. Create. Create anything. It doesn't have to be elaborate. It can be as simple as cooking a meal or singing along with your favorite CD. Tapping into your creative energy helps to get your mind off the pain and onto something that brings you pleasure. And if none of the above suggestions work, remember, this too shall pass. Lori's Toolbox 14. A written note. Let a pen do the talking when you can't. Many of you won't have to deal with pain on a long-term basis, but rather in the fits and starts of your treatment. For some, treatment means surgery. Even though I've gone under the knife 39 times, I still get scared, and I always have questions. How much will it hurt? Will the surgery be successful? How long will it take me to recover? What kind of post-operative pain medication will I be on? To ease my fears and to better manage my post-operative pain, I write a list of my preferences for the surgical team and tape it to the top of my chest. Here are some of the items I usually include. Please use gentle tape. I ask them to back the tape of my IV and specify the tape I prefer. After one of my surgeries, I had a fever which melted the IV tape to my skin. Taking off the tape was more painful than the surgery. Follow the pen marks. I mark the spot where I'd like my catheter to exit with a non-permanent marker, and I indicate the position on the note. I don't want my catheter exiting where my bra strap sits or where the elastic of my underwear lands on my stomach. If you are having a catheter placed but you aren't sure where to make this mark, draw your underwear and bra lines on your body so the surgeon can avoid these areas. Play my favorite song. I list my favorite types of music to play in the operating room. The surgical staff will get a kick out of it, and more importantly, it will remind them that you are a person, not just a patient. Keep my family posted. I remind them to tell my family of my progress. Thank you. I thank them in advance for their good work. It's the power of positive thinking. Use it. Believe me, I know from experience. When you've dealt with pain as long as I have, you discover that a minor adjustment can go miles in quelling an ache. Here's what I do to cope. Hopefully some will apply to you. I rest my feet on a stool. This helps with stiffness by keeping the blood flowing in my legs when I'm sitting. I wear nylons in cold weather. This keeps my legs warm, which also helps with stiffness. I stretch. I take special care to move my body when I have to sit for long periods of time. I use a body pillow. By placing this between my legs while sleeping, I make sure I stay comfortably positioned throughout the night. I also have a good mattress. I buy good shoes. I also wear orthotics. Both have helped immensely in alleviating pain in my knees. I exercise. Swimming is not stressful on joints, so for many people with chronic conditions, it is the best option. I plan ahead. This helps me to avoid getting hurt by moving too fast. I take care when lifting. I try to pick up items properly by bending at my knees, and I avoid lifting heavy objects altogether. I see my physical therapist. Regular visits ensure I keep on top of my body's creaks. Note: if you try these tips, please adopt one at a time, so if your pain is minimized, you'll be able to tell which one worked. Healing by Marguerite Bouvard. When I say the Mesa healed me, I am speaking of how my hands turning the pages of a book were drenched in light, how the house where I lived with its table and chairs became as small as my illness beside the mountain's blue-gray wash, the desert's endless sweep. The sky came, bringing gifts of iridescent blue, clouds, and wind. I was sheltered by its wings. Mornings, when haze still swathed the distances, I sat on the porch, breathing in silence and feeling the presence of all that is. On the mesa, I was granted a reprieve from pain, from a world out of balance that spells itself within my flesh. In my heart, I was whole.